Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The court is now in session. The judges are Judge Smith, Judge Sleater, and Judge Gaitas, the Honorable Theodora Gaitas presiding.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our December 9th, 2021 calendar. This morning, we have five cases on the calendar, and three of those cases are scheduled for oral argument. This is our first case of the day, and the case is in the matter of the civil commitment of Anthony John Dentz. I will just note that we are appearing via the Zoom platform today, and counsel, we are recording these arguments. It will be an audio recording that should be available on our website shortly. I think you're both familiar with our timing requirements, but I'll briefly refresh you. Appellant will have 15 minutes, respondent will have 15 minutes, and then appellant can have 15 minutes, or 5 minutes rather, for rebuttal. Are you both prepared to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
I am.
Okay. Then, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Good morning. Judges, Ms. Pipenhagen, my name is Dan Kufis, and I'm representing Anthony Dentz, who's the appellant in this matter. And we are appealing a ruling from the district court that found that committed Mr. Dentz as a sexually dangerous person under 253D.02. This is a ruling that came back after a reversal and remand from a previous order that the Court of Appeals reversed and remanded. Now, the Court of Appeals reversed the previous order based on some clearly erroneous findings and a misapplication of the law. It's our position that they may have rebranded or renamed something, but the spirit of that misapplication of the law still applies. In order to civilly commit somebody as a sexually dangerous person, the court must find that that individual engaged in a course of harmful sexual conduct. It must find that they have a manifested sexual personality disorder and that they're highly likely to engage in future acts of harmful sexual conduct. The two elements today that we're appealing are the first and the third element. Now, to find that, that the conduct was harmful, the court must find clear and convincing evidence that there's a substantial likelihood of serious or physical harm. Now, the legislature has made a determination that certain conduct is presumptively harmful. That's under 253D.02 subdivision 8B. And they have listed crimes, first degree criminal sexual conduct, second degree criminal sexual conduct, where there is a rebuttable presumption that these actions or these crimes constitute this substantial likelihood of harm. What Mr. Dentz has been convicted of in his conduct, none of his conduct falls under that presumptively harmful. So when conduct is not presumptively harmful, the burden then shifts to the state in this matter, and the state must prove by clear and convincing evidence that the conduct that was engaged in is likely to create a substantial likelihood of serious physical or emotional harm. In this case, the crimes or the actions in question include viewing of child pornography, or possession of child pornography, as well as a fifth degree criminal sexual conduct, neither of which these fall under the rebuttable presumption. The court, the district court, relies in what I consider to be improperly on both Lovejoy and Scott to find that they don't need to show actual harm for possession of child pornography. The case differs if the Lovejoy case differs from the case at hand, and that Lovejoy had multiple other offenses that fell under this rebuttable presumption of harm. So that taken as a totality, when you have proven the harm with the rebuttable presumption element and then added in with the child pornography, that's how they got the substantial harm.
Mr. Kufis, I just want to inquire about a couple of other factual findings. Sure. That the district court made on the remand. And I do understand your concern about a potential rebuttable or irrebuttable presumption even regarding the child pornography offenses.
Sure.
But the district court in its factual findings 58 and 59, in addressing that harmful past sexual conduct element, did list a number of other types of harm that occurred, and the sources of those harm. Specifically, the district court said soliciting children for sex, engaging in sex with a minor, viewing both adult and child pornography, and soliciting photos from minors was the type of conduct that creates a substantial likelihood of serious emotional or physical harm to the victim. So, separate and apart from your concerns about the court's remarks regarding the child pornography, I'm wondering yep. why factual findings 58 and 59 are insufficient under the test that the district court needed to apply.
Because none of those actions in and of themselves are presumptively harmful either. So essentially what the court is doing is looking at these, that these actions occurred, not taking any direct evidence that there was emotional or physical harm. And again, I would argue making the presumption that it is harmful because there was no direct evidence that came in that harm occurred. There was evidence of the acts, but there was no evidence of the actual emotional or physical harm.
But doesn't the language of the statute sort of undercut that argument in that there needs to be proof of actual harm by using the language substantial likelihood of harm? And what does that language mean?
Well, I think that if you're looking at this as that there's a substantial likelihood of harm, there still would have been some need for some direct evidence that harm occurred. I don't think that, the court used the saying, well, I'll go back to the child pornography, that they wouldn't be required to bring in victims of child pornography, but they would need to be required to bring in something. And if you look at in the Lovejoy case, they had a doctor testify at length about the harms of child pornography. And I think that's how that got in. I think that's how that got connected in with the other elements. But in this case, there was no testimony to that fact. There was testimony that the act occurred. And that I think by making that leap and saying that because this occurred, we think that it's harmful is putting an unfair presumption on that conduct.
Mr. Kufish, can I just clarify then, sure. The last half, at least, of your answer to Judge Gaitis seem to concede that one would not need to have specific direct actual harm of a victim, but some form of expert testimony, correct? And well, if that's the case, could not in this case, or did not, maybe I should ask it that way, the expert who did testify relative to the harms of the individuals who pose nude would have, in a general sense, would that satisfy the statutory requirement? And did it occur here?
Well, I think that the first part, there's one mention, I think, in Dr. Kenning's testimony, where she refers to it as abuse. And I think that's on page 63 of the transcript. She refers to children that pose an abuse as abuse. But for that to rise to the level of clear and convincing evidence, no, I don't believe so. I think that if that were the case, then, and if the courts were able to bring in, to use citing the other cases that explain that the harm that child pornography comes, then I think it's creating a new rebuttable presumption. I think if the legislature wanted it included, it would have been included.
So can I just clarify, maybe I'll reframe the question to Mr. Sure. Kufish. What in this particular case do you believe the county, what evidence do you believe they needed to present that would have, from your standpoint, satisfied the non-presumptive substantial risk of substantial
I think harm? They'd have to show it by clear and convincing evidence. I mean, what exactly?
But what I'm getting is what's the evidence that they would need to present then in this case to get to the clear and convincing from your standpoint?
Well, we don't think that there is a presumption of harm. No.
I think everybody, and the judge himself said there is no presumption. Yep. And so we're all agreeing, I believe, that there's no presumption under statute. But what you're indicating by the evidence they did present, they didn't rebut, they didn't create the evidence necessary absent a presumption. My question is, what evidence is missing? What did they need to present here that was not presented?
You mean how would they have succeeded to make it?
Yes.
I think that would be a determination for the district court judge to make. What I think is that one doctor coming in and saying that it's abusive behavior does not rise to that level of clear and convincing evidence. So what that means, if they wanted to bring in experts, I mean, that would be a determination for the judge to make.
Well, I think, though, your argument is, as a matter of law, it was insufficient. So our question is, what is sufficient? And you've talked about the possibility of expert testimony. Is there any other kind of evidence that the state could use? And again, this is all, we're taking a presumption off the table. It's just, what does the state need to prove by clear, convincing evidence to show a substantial likelihood of harm? And could it include, so you've mentioned expert testimony, which you said in this case, I think was not sufficient to meet the standard. Could it include factual information about the crimes themselves? Depending on the facts of the crime, the underlying offenses, whether those in fact would, a judge could determine from those facts that there would be a substantial likelihood of harm, even if there's not direct evidence from the victims.
I ask that
just to get to the child pornography, if we know specific facts about these particular offenses that lead one to conclude, well, of course, you know, given by what those images were, what was happening with those children, one could reasonably conclude by clear and convincing evidence that there's a substantial likelihood of harm.
I think that if you look at the if you look at the Scott case that the court cited, if you look at the Lovejoy case, there's a situation where they had gone and they had looked at previous actions that he had taken, and they had made a determination that those actions that occurred would have fallen under the statute that creates the rebuttable presumption. So they used that evidence without calling the direct witnesses in, but they said that the conduct rose to that level to fall under, in this case, it was a fourth degree criminal sexual conduct. The court explicitly said, though, that conduct that came in at a fifth degree criminal sexual conduct did not rise to that presumption. So they did not use that case.
So I'm out of presumption land because there's no presumption, but the statute doesn't preclude there being clear and convincing evidence of a substantial likelihood of harm for non-presumptively harmful offenses.
That's correct.
Right?
Yeah.
So we're out of that realm. Isn't it possible that an offense for which there is not a presumption, that the facts of that offense itself, I'm asking if it's possible, create evidence without having the victim testify I was harmed, that the facts themselves are sufficient to show a substantial likelihood of harm, it's not a presumptive conviction?
Right. And so I think that if the elements themselves, so if the conduct
the
itself,
facts, the facts.
If the facts themselves laid their way in where they were, that they resembled one of the presumptible harmful conduct, then I think that the court could. But I don't.
Judge Smith, you're mute.
I know, I'm having trouble there. So they don't satisfy the elements, but they resemble it, you're saying? Then it could be enough? How do we get a non-presumptive, how is there a non-presumptive proof related to a non-presumptive crime? Is it only if it satisfies the elements of that crime? It goes to the elements of the crime? So only crimes that have a presumption are sufficient in and of them relating to the facts themselves as proof. It's only if it actually would actually satisfy one of those.
If it would rise to that level. The cases where non-presumptive behavior has come in, there's also a slew of presumptive behavior that's with that.
Mr. Kufis, I was going to ask you that question. Are you aware of any cases like this where there is no presumptive behavior that's included with non-presumptive?
No. I was unable to find any. And I looked, and the ones even cited by the court where they use child pornography, they had first degree, second degree, crim sex that they could tie in with it. So it was just, I think that the non-presumptive crimes in those cases were used to show the course of behavior. So they were tied in to show a course of harmful behavior, but not the specific itself.
It is possible, though, for there to be a non-presumptive crime, just non-presumptive offenses that do satisfy, do meet the standard, as long as you would say there's evidence.
As long as it's direct evidence that comes in, and it's the county's burden to bring in that direct evidence. So yes, it is possible.
What about a criminal complaint? I mean, and I'm sort of in hypothetical land. Could a judge take a look at a criminal complaint charging, a non-presumptive offense after the person's been convicted of that offense, for example, and say, based on the factual allegations here that the defendant admitted to, this is one of those kinds of offenses where the person was likely to suffer substantial emotional harm?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, I think it would depend on what evidence came in. I think just a charging document in and of itself wouldn't be sufficient, because there wouldn't be any, because the actual conviction, I believe, in that case would be what would matter.
And if the person pleaded to the facts or agreed to in that underlying plea to the facts in the complaint, for example, because I think here, and this is what I was wondering about too, I think there were 6 counts of possession of child pornography. There's different descriptions in the complaint about the factual basis, I think, for each of those counts. I'm not sure how the convictions precisely line up to the factual basis. I think because I saw a reference once to an infant involved in one, others were prepubescent children more generically. I don't know if there's evidence in the record that tells us what the convictions related to in terms of the alleged facts.
None of the child pornography charges would fall under the presumptively harmful.
Okay. Right. I'm just wondering what about the factual circumstance. They were separately described, the different counts, I think, in the complaint, but I don't know that if we know which guilty plea relates to what factual description in the complaint.
I guess I don't understand the question.
Oh, that's okay.
All right. So, Mr. Kufas, your time is up. You will have the opportunity to answer that question or say anything else that you'd like to say during a 5-minute rebuttal. But now we're going to hear from Ms. Pippenhagen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors, Counsel, Mr. Kufas. My name is Heather Pippenhagen. I'm an assistant Dakota County attorney, and I am here on behalf of the respondent in this case, the Dakota County Attorney's Office. In this case, the district court clearly found, as noted already in findings 58 and 59, for example, that there was a course of harmful sexual conduct in this case. Now, just to be clear, in appellant's brief, the issues raised in the brief, appellant did not challenge the general sufficiency of the evidence to support that finding of harmful sexual conduct. What that was challenged in the brief was the district court's analysis of the child pornography charges. And what appellant argued is that the district court, in essence, applied a de facto presumption of harm, even though the district court specifically said there was no presumption of harm. So that was the focus of my response in my brief. But what I heard Mr. Kufas say on oral argument today that I think I do need to address broader is the comment that none of the appellant's conduct creates the statutory presumption of harm. That statement is incorrect. That is incorrect. In the brief, appellant stated that none of his convictions carry the statutory presumption of harm. That is correct. But today in argument, the statement that none of the underlying conduct creates harm, that is incorrect. So I want to go through the course of conduct, which I wasn't going to do, but I just want to take a minute to do that. First of all, February of 2014, appellant had oral and vaginal sex with a 14-year-old girl. That was the Anoka County case. He was allowed to enter a plea to fifth degree criminal sexual conduct, which does not carry the statutory presumption of harm. However, the underlying behavior that he admitted to in the course of the investigation, and these documents were put in the record in this case, along with the behavior he admitted to Dr. Kenning when she interviewed him, I mean, there's never been a denial that he had oral and vaginal sex with this victim. That is actually criminal sexual conduct in the third degree. And that does have the statutory presumption of harm. So it is incorrect to say that none of the offenses in appellant's course have the statutory presumption, because that one does clearly have a statutory presumption of harm. So then going on, February of 2016, he was communicating online with a 13-year-old girl, asking her to meet up with him to engage in sexual intercourse. Again, he is trying to get this girl to engage in third degree criminal sexual conduct with him. Thankfully, that didn't happen, but that was what he was attempting to do. In the course of that investigation, the appellant himself admitted to communicating with five of her friends in the same manner, trying to get them to meet up with him and trying to get them to engage in sexual intercourse with him. Two of those girls were 13 years old. One of those girls was 14 years old. Also in Dodge County, not a conviction, but he acknowledged the offense when he was interviewed by Dr. Kenning. It was dismissed when he went to prison. Sexual communication with a 12-year-old girl. And then finally, the offenses that were challenged here on the appeal, the possession of child pornography offenses, that conduct. So that occurred in 2016. The conduct that is alleged, and again, appellant does not deny, is possession of approximately 90 images of child pornography, including prepubescent and infants being sexually abused. No denial of the facts of that case, that he possessed the images, and he even admitted, I believe with Dr. Kenning, that he masturbated looking to at those images. So that's the conduct. That's different than the convictions, and there's no requirement for the convictions either to consider them in the course of conduct. That's clear. I think, you know, this panel is well aware of that. But also the statute establishing the presumption of harm, it says there is a rebuttable presumption that conduct described in the following provisions. It doesn't require conviction. So I just think it was important to clarify that when we're looking at the entire course, the court was going to evaluate the entire course rather than just the district court's treatment of the child pornography offenses, which is what was raised on appeal.
I'm sorry, I'm having a little feedback there. I heard you talk about, I think it's specifically in reference to the child pornography possession, that it was alleged and he did not deny. Can you put those two words and those concepts in the context of the state's burden of proving the likelihood of substantial likelihood of harm?
Yes. So what we put into evidence is the criminal complaints that describe the conduct in the various district court paperwork. He was convicted of a couple of those. And then also in evidence are his statements to Dr. Kenning during the course of her evaluation of him. Those are contained within her report. That was offered as an exhibit. The district court can certainly consider the evidence that was submitted in the criminal complaint. Hearsay is admissible. Anything that
why can evidence in the criminal complaint be considered as part of the state's proof that something happened if that conduct wasn't admitted to? Like I think you said he admitted to some of the conduct in the complaint. I'm not understanding why an entire complaint of allegations without knowing what was actually admitted to would be evidence.
That criminal complaint was put in to put those facts of that offense, and that's the reason why we offered the criminal complaint. In the complaint, the actual sexual acts are described along with his admissions to them. And his admissions are also then outlined in Dr. Kenning's report. And that evidence is admissible in commitment cases. The rules of evidence are different in commitment cases. Any evidence that the court would reasonably rely on is admissible in a commitment case. Typically in a criminal case, a complaint is hearsay, so it's not admissible, but that is not the case in a commitment case. So we don't actually bring the victims in if we can put in the facts through the criminal complaint and other documents.
Ms. Pippenhagen, I'm a little unsure. I understand that answer in terms of the evidence, but maybe I'll just phrase it a little differently. Would you agree that the scope and nature of the county's burden is significantly different in this case, where there's no presumption, and therefore the type of evidence that you would need to present. It sounds like you're just talking generally, but most cases where there's a presumption and you've got a conviction for one of the counts for which a complaint alleges, it's almost a difference without distinction, because you've got the presumption and the burden is on the respondent to somehow disprove. But here, because the entire burden at clear and convincing of substantial, serious physical or emotional harm seems like a much different and, of course, higher burden. And my understanding here is that we only have the two witnesses, the respondent and then Dr. Kenny, who doesn't recommend commitment. So I'm trying to understand, following up Judge Smith's comments, it would seem to me, wouldn't that be different if only the things he would admit to would, the judge couldn't rely on other statements when the burden in this case is solely on the county to demonstrate those incidents. So you were describing broadly, for instance, solicitation, and maybe this is in the record, whether he knew they were 12 and 13 and those sorts of facts. Is that all available to the judge that you believe satisfied the burden of proof by clear and convincing evidence?
Yes, it is our position that it does. That is why we put in the criminal complaints that describe the facts of those offenses. And then Dr. Kenning went through those offenses with him, and he did not dispute the facts of those offenses.
So just to clarify, everything that's alleged in a complaint is admissible, you believe, under commitment rules, regardless of hearsay rule? In other words, rules of evidence don't apply?
Yes, the commitment rules state that anything that would be reasonably relied on by a person can be admitted. So hearsay is admissible in a commitment case. And there was no objection to the admission of those complaints. We stipulated at the beginning of the trial to the admission of all of those exhibits and evidence going in. So there wasn't any objection to that. So I just want to be clear. I think when the conduct, the statute says the conduct creates a rebuttable presumption. So the conduct is having oral and vaginal sex with a 14-year-old girl. And that is criminal sexual conduct in the third degree. The fact that he ultimately only pled to fifth degree doesn't change that presumption. And I mean, to broaden that, a conviction, no conviction at all is required. In fact, on offenses that were never charged can be considered by the course in a course of sexual conduct. So it's still evidence, even if he ultimately pleads to a lower offense, is what I'm getting at.
Just sort of changing gears slightly. So I understand your argument, how you went beyond the child pornography. Just looking at your brief, if we can then just switch gears. In your brief, you talk about the court's findings with respect to child pornography. This is page 8 of your brief. And you say, viewed in a light most favorable to the district court's ruling, the evidence presented at the hearing established a course of harmful sexual conduct. The district court's findings about the nature of child pornography offenses alone can arguably support a finding of the court. I want to get to that. Yeah.
Yes. So again, the argument by appellant on appeal is that the court, in their language, and I believe the terminology that appellant takes issue with is the district court statement, it's impossible to conclude that there is not harm with these offenses. So I think what is important is that the district court and this panel look at the facts of this case. It is true that possession of child pornography generally, that there is no statutory presumption of harm. And that is because the facts of those cases can vary greatly. For example, we have a case here where it's prepubescent and infant children being sexually abused. The appellant is a complete stranger downloading these images and possessing them. That's one factual situation. Here's another factual situation we see in child pornography case. I have it this week. 18-year-old boyfriend, 16-year-old girlfriend. He talks her into taking explicit photos of herself and sending them to him on his phone. That is child pornography. Her mom finds it. He has it on his phone. He's possessing child pornography. Also discovered that she, having consensual sex with him, which she is at an age where she can do, also agreed to have it photographed and videotaped as part of their sexual relations with each other. He possesses these. That is child pornography. It's the exact same offense. It meets that statute. We sometimes have to charge those cases, but that's very different than the facts here. I would not go into district court and argue in the scenario I just described that 16-year-old girl, that there's serious substantial likelihood of harm to her by her boyfriend possessing child pornography pictures of her that she agreed to give to him and agreed to let him have. In this case, this is very different. And the district court looked at the facts of this case. And that's what I would encourage the panel to focus on, is the facts of this case. Images of prepubescent and infant children being sexually abused, they're then disseminated. He is the demand for that supply. A complete stranger downloading those and having the ability to watch them as much as he wants. That is a lot different for those children when you start looking at the likelihood of harm, the fact that they were abused,
Can I just interject here? I mean, how often are we civilly committing individuals based on possession of child pornography alone? I mean, how many cases are there where that first element is satisfied by that act?
I don't imagine, I guess I haven't obviously reviewed the facts of every single SDP case to see if there's ever been one with child pornography alone is the only thing. I would not petition that. I would not. Again, you would have to look at the facts of the case. You know, who is possessing the images? How were they created? How did the defendant get those images? What is the age of the children? Did they agree to have these pictures taken? Were they capable of agreeing? I mean, all these facts would play into it, but that's not what we have. We definitely do not have in this case just possession of child pornography. I mean, we have a very solid course of harmful sexual conduct in this case. And there is case law that says that in the course of harmful sexual conduct, other acts may be considered as part of the course, even though those acts do not themselves meet the harmfulness standard. So you can consider acts as part of the course, even if they don't meet the harmfulness standard. And that specific case, that language actually came out of an unpublished case, In Re Alverson, Alverson. So that just to kind of answer your question, every offense does not have to meet the harmfulness standard, but I wouldn't imagine a petition going forward if none of them did. So I think in this case, the district court properly evaluated the entire course of conduct that the appellant had here and outlined it in finding 58, the respondent's conduct, soliciting children for sex. That's his attempts to have sex with these 13 and 14-year-old children. Engaging in sex with a minor. That's the 14-year-old that he had sex with. Viewing both adult and child pornography. I guess I'm not sure why the adult pornography was included in there, but the child pornography. And soliciting photos from minors.
Can I ask a question? I see you're out of time, if this is okay, Judge Gaitis. Finding 59 then, just in light of your previous argument about that it's the conduct at issue with respect to the legislative presumption. Was the district court wrong in your view by saying, while there is no legislatively created rebuttable presumption, the course of conduct here created a substantial likelihood? Put that in context of your earlier argument, please.
Well, I think the district court was actually limiting itself more than it had to. I think the district court was thinking in terms of convictions. And keep in mind also this order was issued after a remand saying he erred by applying a statutory presumption. So he's making a point to say there's no legislatively created rebuttable presumption, but of course his course of conduct created a risk of substantial harm. I don't know if he was only referring to the child pornography there. I think he was referring to the entire course. And again, I think the judge was thinking in terms of convictions. And the district court perhaps didn't even realize he had broader authority to consider just conduct, which is what the statute allows.
Thank you very much for your argument, Ms. Pipenhagen. And now we'll go back to Mr. Kufis. Mr. Kufis, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Sure, thank you. When I look at this and when I hear Ms. Pipenhagen's argument, specifically referring back to the child pornography, and the varying degrees of it, it's an issue for the legislature. If the legislature felt that varying degrees, if there's varying degrees of child pornography charges that should be considered, then it would have been added to the statute. Mr. Dentz has served his time for the criminal offenses. He's been punished criminally. We're talking about the extreme civil commitment as a sexually dangerous person. And the legislature has said that child pornography isn't in, it's not one of those presumptible areas. So I don't see it as an issue of the varying degrees of it, or if the, you know, the age or the victim or how many pictures, or it's an issue that the legislature has clearly made a determination not to keep in. And that also applies just because—
although you would agree if the victim, for example, if he had a child pornography case and that the victim the victim of the photos or whatever the images are, if that person testified to harm.
Oh yeah.
You would agree that that could be. So it's not this, that the crime itself is outside the scope.
No. If somebody came in, yeah, absolutely.
So again, we get back down to what more is required.
What more is required. And I think I think in order for that, there has to be direct evidence. And in this case, rising again to that clear and convincing standard, it just wasn't there. It's just not there. And in relation to the allegations made about whether something would be third degree conduct, whether it be fourth degree conduct, I mean, the only thing that we have, or the final thing that we have, is the decision of the court that he was charged and convicted of fifth degree crim sex, which does not fall under the statutory presumptions.
What about, so we have our presumptive offenses, right? Yep. And presumably a conviction of one of those offenses would be sufficient to create the presumption. What if you're outside of the scope of those offenses and you have, as we do here, convictions for multiple non-presumptive offenses? Does the course of conduct, which seems to be what the district court was referring to and what Ms. Pippenhagen was referring to, does the course of conduct alone create a likelihood of the serious emotional harm?
Well, it's a course of harmful conduct. So in order for there to be the course, there has to be, in my argument, would be multiple incidents of harmful conduct. So that's how we get to the course. So in order to, if we're going to look at it presumptively, if there's actions that were not presumptively harmful, and there was a course of those, and evidence was brought in showing actual harm, if there was direct evidence brought into court of harm, then yes, I suppose they possibly could. But in this case, there was not. Does that answer the question? I'm sorry. Okay. So we would ask that the court reverse the lower court's decision. That is all.
Thank you both very much for your helpful arguments this morning. The case is now submitted to the court and we'll issue our decision within the statutory timeframe.